What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Being realistic.
As the story grows.
I'm here with Jared Norris, and welcome aboard, Jared. Thanks for joining the story. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing fantastic. Yeah, thanks.
What you drinking? I hear ice cubes. Don't go hiding it on me.
Irish Mule, ginger beer, and Jameson.
And a boy. Me too.
Here's the Irish. Cheers.
So, this conversation came to the recommendation from Matt Putman.
Yes.
Man, I'm surviving off that Matt Putman interview that we did back with Black Vinyl Collective. I at the end of it, me and Matty go back to when he was in Living Sacrifice. And
okay.
When we were done talking to him and his 16 projects that he's been in,
yeah,
I said, I kind of did the whole salesman thing where I'm like, hey, can you recommend anybody else that'll be on here? And dude reached out to everybody. He was like, you should talk to this guy. You should talk to that guy. And you were among that list.
Yeah, he told me about that, and of course I listened to. That's when I started listening to your podcast. So, yeah, that was a great interview, and he's a good friend I've known for many years. I haven't seen him in many years either, but
right,
you know, he's we keep in touch via social medias and that kind of thing. So yeah, he's a good dude. Always has been.
We're a big advocate of Matt on this podcast. We love you. We hope you're listening, and if you're not listening, to hell with you. We don't like you anymore.
There you go.
But when he said Jared Norris, I was kind of like, what band was he in?
Well, who's that guy?
Yeah, who the hell is Jared? And I didn't know who I'd be talking to or what I'd be talking to you about. He gave me a little bit of a rundown of what you've been involved in, and here turns out, fellow listeners, that Jared has been involved in more musical things than some of the guests who were in some of the bigger bands. This is some pretty interesting stuff, and we've got a lot to cover. So let's just get into it, man. How old are you?
I just turned 36.
36. 36 years young.
Yeah.
All right. So you're right. You're a couple years. You're right around Steven's age. You're only like a year younger than Steven. I'm a couple in front of you, but... So you came up through the same scene that we always seem to be talking about. This is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I listened to a lot. I just started listening to podcasts like back in November.
Okay.
Not something I really ever did before, but with kind of the array of guys like us, you know, I listened to Never Was, Urban Achiever, and your podcast as well, and listening to a lot of the guys that are interviewed in bands and are just people that were involved in that, you know, that scene 20, 25 years ago coming out, my story is really not much different than a lot when it comes to the introduction of things.
All right, this will be a short one then. I guess we're talking
to dinner. Yeah, that's it. But you want me to start from when I was introduced with how I got into punk and hardcore and metal and all that?
Perfect. Start at the beginning. That's my favorite place to start. If we start in the middle and we got to jump around, it gets all Quentin Tarantino and it's like impossible to edit. So,
right.
Yeah, man. Just lay it out, man. Where to get
even
started.
He has a hard time editing.
Yeah, even his stuff doesn't make sense at the end, right?
So, everything to me goes back to the Beastie Boys.
Wow. That's
where it all starts. I have to give. When I was a little kid, like, I don't know, six.
Let me interrupt you. As soon as we're done, I'm going to go upstairs and tell my wife that, and you might actually be the first episode she listens to.
Right on. That's where it started, man, with the License to Ill record, the first one, you know.
Yeah, man. Soda and Pie.
Yeah, I was 6 years old, and a neighbor down the street had it. You know, I was raised in a very conservative Christian home, so I wasn't allowed to have stuff like that in the house. But I'd go down there and play basketball in his driveway, and we'd listen to that in the garage. And that kind of set my musical taste, I guess.
That's crazy. The first time I ever heard License to Ill, I was playing basketball with my friend, and his name was Jared Wiley. Swear to God. Yeah, isn't that funny? That is weird.
It's a small world. That's, you know, we're not that special.
No, we're not.
Yeah, so that's kind of where it started, but obviously I couldn't have stuff like that in the house. We had like a local rap station that I used to listen to, and I grew up, just for the record, I grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. Okay. And so that's where the tape hiding began that we're all very familiar with.
Very.
And then I started skateboarding like in 87 or 88, kind of that second or third boom. I don't remember, whatever, with skateboarding with the Bones Brigade guys and all that. Okay. And I was, eight or 9 years old. And through skateboarding, getting the Thrasher magazines and stuff, I started finding, you know, Slayer, Anthrax, Metallica, of course. Those are the early, my early secular, for lack of a better term, music that I was right introduced on. To.
Anthrax was my jam. Good show.
And DRI even. I couldn't really get super into it for very obvious reasons as an 8 or 9 year old kid trying to listen to satanic metal.
Sure. Frowned upon in the Christian home, right?
Of course. So, I remember going to a Christian bookstore about
satanic, Anthrax. Yeah. They're the five of the biggest morons you ever met. They're nice dudes, whatever.
He didn't say hi to me when I ran into him on the street, so I don't have love for Ian right now.
Okay, fair enough.
Anyway, so I remember going to a Christian bookstore about that time, you know, late 80s, and my stepdad, who was going through seminary at the time, told me, you know, find something and, you know, find a cassette or whatever in here that would grab your, you know, that you would like to listen to.
Okay.
So I walked out with Petra, This Means War.
Yes! I love that album. I don't care what anybody
says. Yeah. And so that was like my first introduction to Christian hard rock, I guess, you know, whatever you want to call that. This Means War.
Nice.
And I thought it was like the heaviest to me, because I was allowed to listen to it. I could just turn it, you know, just crank it up.
Right, right.
And so that was kind of a big deal to me. And then somewhere along the way, I found the Heaven's Metal magazine. I wish I could say that The Crucified was my first kind of introduction to like that, to like the Christian side of punk and hardcore, but I don't think that it was. But I found them somewhere around, you know, 90, 91.
Yeah, we all landed there anyway, so
right. But I was heavily into Tourniquet and Deliverance, and
my man, now we're talking.
Vengeance Rising,
yes. You know,
to me, that stuff was
make my day. Say Believer.
You know, Believer came later.
Okay,
I wish I could, but Believer came a little bit later. Probably, you know, it's kind of a blur. I just remember that the first ones I listened to were the Deliverance and Tourniquet and Vengeance Rising, and if you recall, the Heaven's Metal had those VHS like compilations.
Absolutely, I do.
Yep. And I was just super into those. And so for me, it was like, oh, you know, I can't listen to Slayer, you know, on my own. You know, I could listen to it secretly on dubbed cassettes and things like that. So
right.
But
let me ask you a quick question, because I feel like I'm listening to myself. This is great.
Right.
did you do the decoy cassettes in case your parents found?
Of course. Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. So yeah, Motley Crue like stayed in the hiding spot.
Nice.
But Shout at the Devil was like, I had like the Maxell 90 with Shout at the Devil on it, and I had it named something else.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah. All right, man, dude.
You know, how
covered,
I did
it. Covered
how
the trail in the snow, man. I love it.
How I did it was I had like the Salty Songbook cassettes, you know, like the little children's cassettes, and I would tape over those. So then it looks like you're listening to, you know, Salty the Songbook or whatever. And
I remember I had one
Charity Church
Metal. Scott Wesley Brown, is that a singer?
I don't know. It doesn't ring a bell.
There was like a bunch of contemporary Christian singers like Michael Card and
yeah,
Scott right. Wesley Brown. And I was like, cool, thanks for the tape. And I break the little tab off me.
And exactly.
I put like Slayer Seasons in the Abyss.
Exactly. Yeah.
Same All right, here. Good. Right on.
And then go to the altar call on Sunday and ask forgiveness for.
Right.
Yeah. So.
All right.
Yeah, that was my introduction. And then. Of course, like skateboarding in the late 80s, early 90s, somewhere along the way, I found, you know, the standards, Minor Threat, Black Flag.
Sure.
Black Flag was actually the first hardcore punk band that I heard on vinyl. And it was, you know, the Damage record. And that changed everything for me. The aggression, it's very, very standard. I'm definitely not alone.
It's a popular story, but I mean, I love hearing it because I found that stuff later. I leapfrogged right over that stuff real quick. We can edit this out. Who cares?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I used to work at an amusement park, and one of the guys who, you know, you got like merch stands and little tiny things to do all over an amusement park. So you only need like two kids in there, right?
Right.
They paired me up with this kid named Christian, right? He you could tell he didn't have X tattoos on his hands, but he used Sharpie and electrical tape on his hands so much that he had like stains on his hands.
Where like permanent outlines.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right. So this kid was like 17 years old. I was 15. I'm an impressionable Christian youth group idiot with a mullet, you know?
Sure.
And, so you're stuck in there you're stuck in there for 8 hours with this dude. And he was like, so, my name's Christian. I'm straight edge. And I'm like, my name's Trav and I'm a Christian. I don't know what that means. So he's like, well, straight edge means, you know, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs. I don't have sex for conquest. The way that he said it, I was kind of like, sex for conquest. Okay.
Wow.
And I'm 15. So I was like, me neither. I don't do any of that stuff. I sure would like to, but I never got an opportunity to because
right.
That's thinning, right?
Exactly.
So he took me under his wing. So here at this older skater punk straight edge kid was like, this is my buddy Trav, and I'm like, I'm accepted by somebody who looks cool, this is great. Well, that kid started preaching the gospel. He was like a militant straight edge kid. He was like, sure. He wanted to know if I wanted to come with him to have like some purity stuff going on, and I was like, I don't know. And then he got in trouble. I don't remember if he got fired and kicked off the premises or arrested on the premises, but I think he was like waiting outside of a smoking area and he like jumped a kid for smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, that's
So I immediately got like this total, like I slammed on the brakes and I was like, straight edge and punk people are bad. And I did an about face and I went straight back to metal. And like later on, like 20 years old, I finally started hearing Minor Threat and all that kind of stuff. I was like, this shit is amazing. Well, oh man, I missed it. So I got turned off. That there's my story. I can't, you know, it's not
it, sure. Whatever. Yeah, no, it, none of us start out unless you had like a dad or a mom, I guess, that was, you know, punk rock. I don't think.
No, you've never met my parents.
You know, same. I think my kids could say that now, though. My kids are very well versed in punk and hardcore and some metal stuff.
But my kids hate it. They hate it.
My kids are, my son especially. My son is 9. He has Down syndrome, and he's mm-hmm. he just latches on to almost anything that I'm into or do.
I love it.
And he, oh man, he's so into it. He loves like H2O and his favorite band is Black Sabbath.
Look at that.
Yeah. I actually took him to see Black Sabbath about almost 2 years ago.
That's great.
Yeah. It was amazing. Then my oldest daughter, she's into like more of like the Ramones and Rancid, MXPX. Awesome.
I'm a little bit jealous. My daughter asked me to load a bunch of crap into her iPod, into her iPhone. And I snuck in some stuff, and she came back to me with like this.
What is this shit?
Yeah, and she was like, Dad, what's the Clash? Oh, no. And I was like, they're you don't like them? And she's like, I don't like it at all. Like, not even to the point where it's like I won't listen to it. She's like, take this off my phone. And I was like, oh my God, remove your knife from my heart. You know,
I didn't set out that to like. My kids are all extremely different, and I never set out to like make them punk rock or hardcore or anything. Right. I think it just comes, you know, guilty by association. You know, it's always on. The stuff's always playing.
Yeah,
they just kind of latch on to the ones that they like. And my daughter doesn't really like the hardcore stuff. She likes the more you know, pop punk and the Ramones, of course, and Clash and.
They're coming around. I have a theory on that. My daughter is actually starting to dig the new Coliseum album.
Oh, dude, it's so good. That's such a great record.
It's literally perfect. It's a perfect album.
God, I pre-ordered that one, and
Coliseum is like they burred the edges off every album without losing the intensity.
Yeah.
I can't think of another way to put it.
So that's a great way to put it.
Thank you. So they kept getting smarter and smarter and smarter with their songwriting and better and better. I can't wait. Ryan is supposed to be coming on. I'm so excited to talk to him.
Oh, that's so rad. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good dude. He seems really cool. And it seems like as these bands are getting older and they're like our age, a little younger, a little bit older, they're starting to kind of, again, burr the edges off. They're not losing their edge, but obviously Anxiety's Kiss doesn't sound like God Damage, right?
Right. No, definitely not.
That's becoming more palatable, more accessible, so that my 12-year-old daughter can hum along
in the water. Yeah.
Right. So I'm gonna work backwards. I'm gonna get them in.
Nice. With
the stuff that's happening now, and then I'll keep stepping backwards. And you know, who knows? Maybe by the time she's 15, she might dig No Salvation. I don't know.
But, yeah. I like that band from the very beginning. And I got a little turned off with the Relapse release.
Hmm.
And I was like, they're, you know, they started getting that more kind of that rock sound to them
right.
Less of the doomy and kind of that raw, the early, you know, God Damage and I really liked that early stuff. And so I kind of like ignored them for a couple of years and then came back around to it. Like from a video or something, I don't remember which one. And now I actually like all of that stuff way more than their early stuff.
See, they found Jay Robbins 3 albums ago.
And, right.
I mean, you're not going to meet a bigger Jawbox fan, and they, just the production and what he does and everything. It just has a certain sound to it, and you like it or you don't. I happen to like thrive on it. My record collection is not big. There's a lot of Jay Robbins over there, though, you know.
Right on. And yeah, Jawbox is can't go wrong with Jawbox.
Channels, Burning Airlines, Office of Fe- it's all over there. But I hear you. Where they kind of the production kind of went down that path, and I like it. But I can see how if you were in it for doomy leather motorcycle jacket, I get it. like Sister Faith may not have been there for you, but
God, I got that record is so good though.
It's awesome. Yeah, I know. And I got into it around then and worked my way back because I started with Believer and Vengeance and Tourniquet and everything. I can always work my way backwards into heavier stuff. Heavy doesn't scare me. I started there. I actually I settled down. I leveled off and settled down as I got older. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
But anyway, dude, I totally cut you off. I'm sorry. Let's.
No, it's just a conversation. I'm not in any hurry. So
okay.
Okay, so early '90s was finding, you know, like the aggressive, hardcore punk, Black Flag, Minor Threat. Being a skater at the time, all my friends listened to like all the Fat Record stuff, Pennywise, NoFX, right. I mean, not Fat, Epitaph, and Bad Religion, and that kind of stuff. And I immediately latched on to a lot of those bands as well. Mm-hmm. And so being a part of that, and then the early '90s like that, and I was pretty young, you know, I was, you know, 12, 13 years old, you know, this has got to be 90, 91, 92, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, yeah, about 91, 92. Make sure I get my lies correct here.
Line up the lies, man. Right. I'm going to have my fact checkers all over your eyes.
Right. So then when of course, with the tooth and nail thing, as being in a Christian home, and you know, it was, you know, obviously a big part of my life, and finding these, I remember the first ad I saw was the Focused ad for Bow, and he's where the Tin Man, the singer's like right up in the camera with the microphone.
Okay.
And I was like, holy, what is this? There's a hardcore band that's legitimately, you know, like a Christian hardcore band.
Okay.
And this was what, 93,
I believe. Sounds about right. I can't picture the ad, but yeah, that sounds right.
I graduated
in 93. That sounds right. Yeah.
I've still got the ad, and it just the that right there, and somewhere in there, I had found the Crucified and Living Sacrifice. And for the record, the Crucified is still probably my favorite band of all time. I still have my original copies of Pillars. Pillars was the first record that I got.
Cassette or CD?
Cassette. And then I bought the CD like a couple years later. Nice. And then of course, being a self-proclaimed vinyl nerd, when those were pressed on vinyl a few years ago, that's, you know, I was a little late to the game. Like, I don't think nowadays I don't really keep up with a lot of like what's going on with Christian whatever music, heavy punk or hardcore, anything that's Christian related really to speak of. So I was kind of late to the game. I think I, like a couple years after those were released on vinyl, I found out, but I jumped on it right away. Anyway, all time favorite band is the Crucified. I like all of their stuff, but Pillars has got to be like my desert island record. It's just perfect. Everything about that record to me is perfect.
My cousin that I co-host with, we're in a band that never seems to get off the ground, but we play together and record and stuff, called Unteachers.
Okay.
And we came really, really close to doing a B-side. We already did a B-side of Vengeance, Fill This Place With Blood for a 7-inch.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And we came really, really close to doing a Crucified cover.
Sweet.
So when I said, well, Steven, which song should we do? Like, without hesitation, almost like he had it scripted, he was like, Strength.
Nice.
And I was like, yeah, oh yeah. So we started rehearsing it and practicing it and demoing for it, and we never recorded it. We're probably gonna someday, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, that's that. You should do it, man. That's such, that record never gets old. I can put it on any time of the day and listen. They're just such a great band.
Yes,
I didn't associate the Crucified as being like a punk or a hardcore band to me back then. To me, it was later on, I've kind of figured out there. I think when Tooth & Nail re-released all their back catalog, like in, what was it, 94, 95, the demos and the Take Up Your Cross and all that.
Right.
Is when I really put the connection. Oh, these guys were like a punk, kind of a hardcore punk band first, but to me they're just a thrash band at the time. So Focus was like the first Christian, for lack of a better term, hardcore band, spirit-filled hardcore band.
Mm-hmm.
That I really latched onto, and from there, of course, I latched onto Tooth and Nail right away. I think the first I went to the Christian bookstore and got that Wish for Eden cassette, the Bow cassette, and I liked Wish for Eden. You know, it was
sure.
It's still good. I mean, I could still listen to that. It's still a good record.
You were back there for Tooth and Nail 001, Tooth and Nail 002.
yeah. And then I remember the first MXPX ad for the set. I think it was a 7-inch.
Uh-huh.
For that 17 7-inch. I'm still an MXPX fan.
Okay.
You know, my taste in music is I'd say the older I've gotten, it's become a little more narrow, but there's still. I still like, but I can't listen to a lot of the old MXPX stuff because it's just very juvenile now.
Mm-hmm.
But their some of their later stuff, he's kind of moved away from the like teenagey kind of girly songs.
Right.
And
you get older.
Yeah, you grow up. Exactly. Imagine that.
I'm 40. I don't want to hear songs about girls.
Right, no doubt.
You know.
So I followed that, and I was. I remember you did your first episode for this one was the way you kind of covered that, that documentary, that Tooth and Nail documentary.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get too into it, but I'll just insert my opinion. I hated it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I thought,
great. We just lost our sponsors. Oh, great.
Right. and I'll, this is why.
Okay.
I felt like, well, I agreed with the criticism of it only being an hour long. That thing could have easily been 3 hours long.
Sure. Yeah, right.
And I felt like the whole time they were trying to prove something, like they were authentic, legitimate, and they didn't need to. Like I don't feel like they needed to prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
They are what they are. They have a fantastic catalog of bands. There's many, many great albums that they've put out. Mm-hmm. So a lot of crap too.
Well, but sure.
That goes with the territory, right. And they came out at a time they weren't. I think the catchphrase for that documentary is like the most controversial record label of the '90s, and I don't really agree with that. I think, or at least for me, it translated as, hey, exactly what they were going for. That's how it translated to me. I was already into metal and punk and hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
And I found these bands that I could latch onto that kind of had that message that I needed.
Right.
That I agreed with, you know, with the Christian message, and I could listen to it without hiding my cassettes, you know, and that kind of thing. And so I didn't like it because I felt like they were trying to prove something and they don't need to. And I felt like it could have been much longer. They kind of stopped at what, like 99, 2000. And then, I understand like the Supertones paid the bills, but they could have just, I hate ska, always have. And I feel like they could have just left. I know it's part of their history, but
I have to admit Tooth and Nail and Solid State put most of the stuff that I was into, but most of the stuff they put out, I liked the fringe stuff that wasn't as popular. I know that
sure.
I know that Supertones and MXPX were paying the bills and everything. I never got into that stuff. I just
right.
Wasn't my cup of tea, but whew, praise the Lord for Strong Arm.
Yeah, no doubt.
Living Sacrifice Reborn. You kidding? That, I mean, what that friggin' album kicked a dent in my skull that hasn't healed yet, you know, but that was possible because you know, everybody was with the horns, and I never skanked for Jesus. It wasn't my thing, but
oh, definitely not.
Paid some bills, I guess. So whatever.
Yeah, I get it. And so that's my if being that kid that grew up from the beginning of that era of Tooth and Nail starting and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I have and then also knowing people that work there and stuff. I feel like it could have been a much better and much longer documentary, and they could have kind of skipped the trying to prove their legitimacy. They're a legit label. I don't care what anybody says. They put out some great bands,
I think that's a fair criticism because Steven said, like, they didn't make that documentary for anybody other than the people that are already into it.
Right. And so I remember that.
You don't have to walk into the room and prove who you are. We came to this documentary because we are already.
Right.
So more than 60 minutes. I feel you. I don't, due to might have been a budget thing. Like I said, if a 2-hour documentary might have cost twice as much, I don't know. If it was just a budget thing and they had to cover what they had to cover, but I'm hoping, I'm holding out on hope that they come out with some sort of a solid state one.
Yeah. No, same.
Yellow hat.
I sent a text to all my friends that were, you know, that I still keep in touch with that were in bands on the label,
right,
and to ask their opinion, and believe it or not, everybody I asked hadn't even seen it yet, and so they're asking me what I thought of, and they're like, well, you should do a documentary. I'm like, I don't want to do that for, you know, now. Well,
you're a teacher, you've summers off,
right? Get them, you know, you do it. But to be, I mean, I haven't even paid attention to Tooth & Nail or even Solid State for that matter for probably over 10 years. So I'm, of course, I keep up with Living Sacrifice and, sure, and have always buy their records. But I think that's the only band anymore that's still on the label that I have a connection to. So
I have to admit, the music comes to me now. I don't pursue it. There's enough out there, and I listen to enough not Christian music now that when the cream really rises to the top and it fights its way through all the other crap, finds its way to me, I'll pay attention. But sure, I'm not on the site like, what do you got now? What do you got now? Like back in the day, it was like,
you were definitely.
Yeah. There were people who like, I like this label. It's like a Discord thing.
Right, exactly.
I never heard of that band. Yeah, exactly. I never heard of that band. I don't know who that is. Oh, they're on Discord? All right, I'll take it. You know what I mean? Like, you just know exactly what he's doing, you know?
Right. It's the same. Yeah, there's you know, in the 90s, it was Victory Records for me.
Right
along with Tooth & Nail, and then a lot of what Epitaph was doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like anything. You labels attract, you know, certain people, and we will almost buy everything from that label until you just start consistently putting out garbage.
Sure.
Which, you know, some of those labels have. So
yes, they have.
It is what it is. Yep. But yes, somewhere in the mid 90s, I kind of, I would say like 94 is where I really, really started to just attach to hardcore. Like that became like my music of choice. And, okay, and you know, to this day, it still is. It's still what I'm drawn to the most, and what I listen to the most. Mm-hmm. What I follow, those are the shows that I typically choose to go to.
Mm-hmm.
That it kind of never went away. So the shows I first started going to were local shows, and at the time I was living in Killeen, Texas, okay, which is in the early 90s. I lived in Killeen from like junior high and high school. My juvenile, I guess you could say, era.
Mm-hmm.
And my stepdad was like a minister of education at a church there, and that's why we moved there from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And Killeen is about 60 miles north of Austin and 60 miles south of Waco. And mm-hmm. you might be familiar with it from the Fort Hood, like the Fort Hood shootings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Hood is the army base, I'm sorry. So Killeen is kind of like the housing community of this base.
Okay.
Very, very culturally diverse. And so I started going to a lot of local shows in and around that area, even down into Austin. And the first shows I went to were local punk shows and local hardcore shows. So the bands that were in and around that area were kind of where I got my cutting my teeth on going to shows, and I didn't actually go to like a big show until like 95, I guess.
Okay.
And the first big show, I'll call it, was like a Tooth & Nail weekend in Irving, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas.
Okay.
And that's where I saw Focus the first time, and Blenderhead, Bloodshed, MXPX. It was it was like the summer of 95, I believe.
And, okay.
So Texas has a real strong connection with the Tooth & Nail labels, and that all those bands and stuff always toured through Texas. My connection with bands started to happen kind of around that time. Summer of 96, Overcome and Strong Arm went on tour, and I went to Austin to see them. And that's where I met all those guys. And I immediately had a connection with the singer of Overcome, Jason Stinson.
Cool.
And now, you know, he lives 3 hours from me. And so to this day, you know, 20 years later, we're still really good friends and have always, you know, kept in touch. I go to Phoenix quite a bit, and definitely one of my best friends. But that's kind of where things started for me right there. And what I noticed at the time was that, especially in Texas, and I don't know how it was in other parts of the country, but in Texas at the time, there was such a huge division between in hardcore shows, and I hated it. Like the next summer, I think the summer of 97, Strong Arm and Zayo played the same place that I saw Strong Arm and Overcome. And they were like double booked with a Veil. And Austin is or at least at the time was, you know, lots of Veil fans, we'll say. So I noticed the show was double booked. Strong Arm and Zayo played first, and there was like 10 of us there to see them. And I was there to see a Veil too, you know, right. But there was this huge separation where like everybody stood in the back, like nobody, like just, you know, because of the stigma attached to it.
Scenesters, you know? Man. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And I always hated that, just hated it. And I was like, this, you know, Strong Arm is amazing. Zayo was, they, I don't even think they had this, they just had the, All Else Failed record out on Steadfast.
Yeah, that would have been pre Blood and Fire. So that was like Zayo.
Yeah, and before, yeah. I think maybe Splinter Shards was coming out. I don't recall.
Okay.
It might have been before, might have been after they recorded. But it was that original, or like close to the original lineup before,
right?
Before the second wave or whatever of Zayo. Anyway. Right. That's where I started making connections with those guys, and I was getting ready to 96 was like my senior year. I graduated in 97, and my goal was to move back to Dallas Fort Worth, which is where I was from originally. Right. And so like my senior year, I started a distro, so I started selling you know, 7 inches and stuff, demos and things at local shows. And Any show I could go to, they would let me set up a table. I would sell
Dead Self, right?
Dead Self, right. However, here's a fun fact. The first show that I set up at was in, I want to say, like the spring of 97.
Okay.
And it was at this place called the Country Church.
Okay.
And way outside of Dallas somewhere. I forget, Kaufman maybe. I don't remember. My friends from back home listening to this will correct me, I'm sure. But it was Zayo was on tour with NIV.
Okay.
And Jason Dunn from Facedown, the drummer for No Innocent Victim, had his distro set up also.
Uh oh.
And this was my first show setting up, and I remember
fight.
before the show, I made up like some like business cards, and I called my distro at the time Facedown.
Oh,
and so I go to this show. This is,
I'm not exactly sure where this is going, but that doesn't sound like a very good idea so far.
Well, it's not going anywhere.
Okay.
Other than that, it's just coincidental that he had his distro, which was much larger than mine, and it was called Facedown. I was
right,
like,
right.
I was like, ah, well, that's not going to work out. And I think there was even like, I immediately connected with Jason Dunn then, you know, and I think there was that kind of like awkward, like, hey, I guess I'm going to have to change the name of my distro. And at the time I had just gotten, like 10, 7 inches of the Disciple Scarab 7-inch.
Okay.
And, from EMS at SA Mob, which is, you know, from there in Pennsylvania, Erie.
Oh yeah.
And that was like, that's what started my distro, was that when that 7-inch came out, EMS sent me a bunch of them on consignment to kind of get my foot in the door, you know. And that helped me out huge. I sold them all at that show, I believe. And then it kind of blossomed from there. But
did you even stay set up that day? Was it just too awkward, or was the guy like, it's cool, just change your name, you know, tomorrow?
I don't remember the exact conversation, and I don't remember if I continued to call it Face Down for the remainder of that show.
Okay.
But I do remember, like, I do remember the kind of awkward exchange, but we immediately, Jason Dunn and I immediately connected, and I haven't spoken to him in many years, but anytime I've seen him ever since then has been, you know, he's a really good dude. I respect what he's doing.
Okay.
And that kind of thing. And so I, obviously he didn't have the Disciple 7-inch with him. So it wasn't, that was all that I had. So it wasn't like a conflict of interest. Like I wasn't selling something he was selling also.
Right, right, right.
So it worked out fine. And then I went home and brainstormed and changed it to Dead Self. And then that's when I started. I got the idea to do a distro from going to local shows in Central Texas and around Killeen where I was living at the time. Because early on I was getting all the demos from hardcore bands and picking up zines like Heart Attack and, I believe Second Nature maybe. All these hardcore zines from this local guy. His name's Noble Brown, and he sang for some local bands, hardcore bands, Brick, and this band called, and before that a band called Minority. Which, if you're from Texas and you do your Texas hardcore history, those are kind of our legendary bands, at least in my opinion.
Brick and Minority. Okay. Yeah. I never heard of them, but worth looking into.
No, they didn't. They never like toured or anything like that. But
right.
But definitely are big down there in Texas.
Right.
And so he's a few years older than me, and this guy that I really looked up to, and he had a distro, and he sold demos and 7-inches and zines and things like that. And I was like, you know what, I want to do that, but I'm going to mix it up. I'm not just going to carry like Christian hardcore bands, and I'm not just going to carry regular hardcore bands. I just want it to be a hardcore distro, just hardcore okay. bands, no matter what. And that's kind of how it started. And I liked the SA Mob approach because they were putting out the Disciple 7-inch, but it wasn't a Christian label.
Mm-hmm.
And for lack of a better term. And I'm only saying that because that's what we all associate it with. It kind of goes without saying.
Yeah, right.
Saying, putting the Christian label on things. So, like, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to mix it up a little bit. And
right.
And that's, I started my distro, and then just setting up in and around just everywhere in Texas, all throughout the mid to late 90s, making connections and that kind of thing. And I wasn't in bands. I wasn't doing anything like that. But eventually when I moved, after I graduated in 97, I moved up to, I went to college at Dallas Baptist University. And so I was doing the distro out of my dorm room. And then I decided, you know what, I'm going to make a label out of this. And I want to put out, I really appreciated compilations at the time. It's kind of a lost art in my mind.
Oh my God. How many bands turned you on? How many bands did you get turned on to from a
compilation?
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So I really liked, I was carrying a lot of stuff from Boots Ahead and Steadfast at the time also, because
mm-hmm.
I liked their approach as well. Especially Matt Traxler from Steadfast. I really liked, I remember he would, when I would order something from him, he'd send me just a ton of zines, and some of them like super offensive. Like if my parents had found them, and I was like, this guy has like, you know, for lack of a better term, like a Christian label, but he's sending me just hardcore zines, and I really appreciated it, but right. I could see how, he's going to be pissing some parents off for sure. And I'm sure he did, but I always liked what he was doing. And he put out the Radio Waves. I think that's the name of the comp. Radio okay. Waves and Gibberish, I think, is what it was called.
Never heard of it.
Oh yeah, it had some. It didn't have. I don't know that it had unreleased songs, but anyway, just some. Had a lot of good stuff on it, and I was like, I want to do this. I want to put out a compilation, but my effort was to put out that it would have mostly unreleased songs
mm-hmm.
for the time. And so it took me about a year to kind of get everything together. And I actually, it worked out. I released it in sometime in 98. I want to say like the summer of 98, maybe. I forget it. And that was my first release. It was called Blessed Be This Killing. And I only pressed 1,000 copies and they sold out like right away. Cause by that time I had my distro, I was making, like catalogs and mailing them out to anybody that ever ordered from me would get a new catalog. And so I had like this, I wasn't just actually most of my, what I was selling through the distro was people were ordering, you know, through mail order. Uh-huh. And I was selling more via mail order than I was, at shows.
What was on, let's hold on here. The Blessed Be This Killing. What'd you have on there?
Okay. So, there's a lot of little rabbit trails I could go on here, but, I had met the guys in Esocaris like in 96 or 97 when they were called Elliot
It's okay.
And, I was on vacation in Arkansas with my family and I was eating at a snow cone. I was getting like a snow cone shack or something. This was when I was still in high school.
Okay.
And there was a flyer on this snow cone shack for Strong Arm and this band Elliot. And at the time I was,
wow.
Like the wheels were already spinning to put out this compilation. So I was looking for bands that,
let's get to the important stuff. What flavor snow cone?
Tiger's Blood, always.
Right on, right on. Yeah. Okay, all right, still, all right.
Still to this day, yeah. Big Tiger's Blood fan.
My man. All right. Strong Arm and Elliot.
So I called the number, and it was Arthur who answered. And I don't remember.
Arthur, he must be 200 years old.
He's like your age.
He's not. He's like he's always been. He's like he pops right up everywhere.
He does. He does. Yeah. And I don't remember the conversation at all. I just remember that's who I talked to. And somewhere along the way, I met up with. I think I went out to Arkansas and saw him play with Living Sacrifice Their first record wasn't even out yet. They might have been recording it and they were going through the name change. That somewhere along there, that's all a blur. But I met those guys and made those connections, and I still keep in touch with all of them, except Jason. I haven't talked to him in probably 6 or 7 years. But
Fruity.
From Esocaris, Jason. I forget his last name, but he played guitar.
Okay.
Yeah. There's Corey, the Putmans, Corey and Matt and Arthur and Jason. And Jason was in another. He started years later. Started in another band called the Handshake Murders.
Okay. I've heard of them.
Yeah, and I saw the last time I saw him was with that band when they were on tour with Norma Jean.
Okay.
But that's been probably six or seven years ago now.
Okay.
But I still talk to Corey and Matt and Arthur. And anyway, somewhere along there, we made that connection. And so Esocaris was like the first track on the record, and it's on the compilation. And it's a song off of the full length that hadn't been released yet, I don't believe.
Okay.
And then I'll go down the list. All right, so you had Esocaris was Born with a Future, which was off of their album.
Uh-huh.
And then Shockwave did Buzzsaw, which was on their demo, but I paid them to re-record that.
You paid Shockwave to re-record Buzzsaw?
Buzzsaw, yeah. And Shockwave and Disciple. I should say Disciple AD, I guess. But at the time, they were just right. Ex-Disciple. So you had Shockwave. And then we had a local band from the Dallas-Fort Worth area called Within.
Mm-hmm.
And their singer went on to do, he did like the second wave of embodiment, Sean.
Okay. All right.
And those guys have been in, those guys, I still keep in touch with all those guys and they're still good friends. I haven't seen many of them in years, but we could pick up where we left off, that kind of thing. Okay, and then the track four was Fanatic, which was they did a split 7-inch with Persevere, I believe, on Face Down, but they're a New York hardcore band, which is which is had some guys from this New York hardcore band called Breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
One of my New York hardcore still to this day is like kind of is pretty much my favorite genre of hardcore. So that was kind of a big deal for me to have them on there.
Oh, okay.
And it starts out with like this Public Enemy intro, and it's pretty goofy, just kind of, you know. And then Seasons in the Field, which was pre-Zayo, Dan and Russ. And that's how I met those guys. And then this band from Australia called Callus.
Okay.
And I think the guy, there was a guy in that band named Nick, maybe, that went on to be in Unwed Sailor, but I'm not positive on that. I think he moved to Chicago and joined up with like the Jesus People.
Wow.
Spitfire did Shadows of Forsaken Promises.
Okay. All right.
So it's very, very early Converge-y kind of sounding stuff. Spitfire was a great band.
Yeah, they were. I was, you ever hear a band called Crutch or Alathian?
No. I've heard you talk about it because those were your bands, but I'm not familiar.
Yeah. And the after I got out, a band called Blind Influence, Crutch went and just pillaged Blind Influence and borrowed all their members, and their drummer replaced me. Their lead singer / bass player became Alathian's bass player, and Andy, his favorite band was Spitfire. It's all the dude talked about. He loved them. Talked about them all the time. Mm-hmm.
My familiarity with a band called Crutch is also another Pennsylvania band, but I don't think it's this. It's the guys from Wisdom in Chains.
Yes. Many a threatened ass kickings came because we had some pipe hitting, tough looking dudes showing up. They were like Crutch, and they were like, oh, this isn't X Crutch spelled with a K, X. This
right.
is Crutch Christian imagine. Tech metal. They were like, we're gonna beat your ass. And we're like, oh no. Yeah, that didn't work out.
That's funny because I was a Crutch fan, spelled with a K, and Wisdom in Chains is probably my favorite modern hardcore band, for lack of a better term. So that's funny, but yeah, that's my association with the band Crutch. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I've heard that story before. I hate that story because...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's cool. But there's been many times where we've had people just like, we got on stage and opened with whatever we were playing, and they were like, turned, did an about face and walked out. We're like, oh, you thought we were
there. Oh, no, that's terrible. Yeah. It was when unfortunately, whatever, the underground punk and hardcore metal scene is, it's hard to come up with new names.
Yeah, really. Hey, it was Crutch when I joined, man. I had nothing to do with it.
So, keeping on with that comp, Society's Finest put one of their early tracks on it. Good friends of mine from Dallas-Fort Worth that eventually signed to Solid State.
And kind of smeared its way into Embodiment too, right?
None of those guys... I mean, definitely friends, all friends.
Right.
All a huge pact of really close guys, including myself with both bands.
Got it. And I thought Chris was in Society's Finest. That's why I said
that. You know what? He might have – God, I can't remember. Yeah, he did play – Chris is one of my best friends, even still.
And good. Get a hold of him. Tell him I want to talk to him.
I definitely will. Yeah, he would be a
– vocalist.
He would be a great interviewee on your podcast for sure.
I met them in 2008 when they were the Famine. I went out and I played.
Fantastic.
Alathian did a reunion show, sort of
nice.
Never broke up, but weren't playing kind of a thing. And we went out and the Famine. Dude, me and Andy just stood there. We were like, oh my god, this is the heaviest thing ever. And talked to all of them. They were all rad. They were such nice dudes.
And that's when Chris was singing for the Famine, correct?
Yep. Right before, I think it was pretty much the last big thing they did before Chris was like, "I'm out." And then their bass player moved over to be the singer.
Sure.
And then,
right?
Yeah, I got lost after that.
Right. There's quite a few things going on in there that I think would be better addressed with Chris than myself.
Get him for me.
I'll definitely do it. So Society's Finest put an early track on there, and a fun fact. The album that came out on the Society's Finest record on Solid State, that's me on the cover, with in a suit with a bag over a brown bag over my head.
Shut up.
Yeah.
That's you?
Yeah, and Chris took the picture, and it's in the bass player Joel's house on his couch.
Interview so. Over. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I've always strive to be the guy behind the scenes. Like, I don't like talking about myself. I don't like being, you know, up front, you know, so that's why you know, you've heard of things I've done, but
right.
I'm a name in the background, and that's totally intentional. I've always,
I'm bringing you out in the forefront. So you're going to have to get used to it for about an hour, man. No big deal. And that's kind of funny too, because I opened the podcast with saying we got to shut the cameras off. You ain't that good looking anyway.
Right.
And here, the one time you step out in the limelight, you take a bag over your head. Dude, it's not my opinion. Maybe everybody thinks you're ugly. I'm just saying. You know?
Yeah, that's my wife doesn't. So that's all that matters to me.
That's all that matters, dude. That's funny.
She likes big sexy, so we're good with that.
Big sexy, I love it. That sounds like a sexy thing, and I ain't touching that.
So then we had Pensive on the comp as well. They did a song off of their EP, Spirit Fall, and that's of course with Brad Dieter. And the guys from every guy I think is either went on to be in Zao at some tenure or Juliana Theory, guys in that band. And then another band from DFW called Travail, who was kind of, they're kind of were like a, like a Deftones, Korn kind of band, but they,
I feel
they
like I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah. They played with every Christian hardcore band that came through. Really good dudes.
Okay.
And they played, you know, for lack of a better term, they played a lot of local hardcore shows, even though they weren't really a hardcore band, but just, they were just good dudes, and they got on the comp. Through and Through, I don't know if you remember that band.
Name sounds familiar.
They put out a full length on Boot to Head at some point. Great band, great dudes from Canada. Actually, another fun fact, one of their guitar players started the band 3 Inches of Blood. So, okay. Which is a fantastic metal band from there.
Yeah.
A band from South Africa called Terra Firma. And then the Disciple... paid them to record Two Faced, which posthumously after the comp, it came out on the European release of that they put out on Good Life. One of their albums, they put it out as like a bonus track.
Okay.
But when I put my comp out, that was an unreleased song, which was a selling point for the comp, of course. A band from Netherlands called Ashfall.
Okay.
And then a band from Minnesota called Fed by Ravens.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
Which I ended up putting a full length out for them a couple years after that. And then, Overcome recorded a song for me as well. Conversion. And that rounded out the record at the end.
No joke, man. Holy moly. That's amazing. That's a lot of hard hitters, dude.
Yeah. For the time, especially, I was super proud of it. I had to get a little bit of help with some friends. I definitely don't want to leave that unnoticed. Two friends of mine, Eric Shirey and Chris Hicks, were starting up a label called Pluto Records.
Hmm.
And which ended up putting out like the first As It Lay Dying stuff. And,
right.
Those guys are good friends and they helped me, they helped me out financially to get that thing going. So they're kind of, their label's kind of tagged onto the back of the J card there. Because I needed some help and right. those guys pulled through. So I definitely don't want to leave them out, but no. only 1,000 copies were ever put out. And then me and my friend Adam, I think we did like 50 like limited copies where we did with like they're all handmade and it was a really cool thing that I gave out to friends and like cool. people that ordered from the distro all the time. So that came out in 98. somewhere along there, I went on tour with Living Sacrifice, Embodiment, and Esocaris.
Gotta talk to you about this. Let me read the email. Let me read the email, listeners. Can I read this? Is that all right?
Yeah, yeah.
I toured with Living Sacrifice, Embodiment, and ESO in the summer of 98, and it was enough to convince me that I never want to tour again, and I never have.
Yep.
What the hell's that mean?
That sums it up. Okay, great friends, all those guys. I love everybody and all today. No beef or qualms with any of those guys.
Okay.
I could always talk with any of those dudes that were on that tour. I had a great time. It was super fun. It was 2 weeks. We went out to the West Coast. I was 19 years old.
Okay.
First time seeing the ocean. Seeing the desert. Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. Oh yeah. So super fun time. I took my distro with me and I guess I would have been, I went out with Embodiment is really who I was, kind of like their roadie.
Okay.
I sold all their merch and then set up my distro as well. And it all, like the whole trip was on the way out to like a Salt State showcase at the Showcase Theater in the Los Angeles area.
Okay.
So it like Warlord and Training for Utopia and those bands played the showcase also. Mm-hmm. Zao wasn't on that one. I think they got stuck or broke down or something like that.
Okay.
So fun, super fun tour, but the AC and the van went out quickly. Esocaris had a lot of problems with their van rolling through Arizona. It was kind of like that point, like, you know what? And I wasn't in any bands at the time, but I determined, mm-hmm. like, we got back and I did really well. Like, I sold a lot with the distro. It was a good experience for me, but it was enough to convince me that I don't want to do this. Like, I don't want to go on tour as a roadie. I don't want to go on tour as a band.
Okay. You don't have a story. Like, I'm hearing a lot of stories lately of like, we didn't sell a lot of records and we didn't do good and we got screwed over by people. So all of a sudden having like a religious crisis and I don't want to get involved in that. You're just flat out saying, I didn't have fun. I don't want to do it.
No, I had fun, but it wasn't worth it to me. Okay. Here, I can piggyback what you're saying.
Go ahead.
I was super bummed at the response. Living Sacrifice, amazing. Embodiment, amazing.
Yeah.
Esocaris, amazing.
Yeah.
Three amazing bands this was the summer of 98. Embodiment, I think, Esocaris' record, we actually picked up from the drummer from POD in San Diego on that tour. Like, they got mailed to it. So their record came out on that tour.
Man, I heard that from somebody on an episode. Wolf had to bring them there.
Yeah, I think Bruce talked about it, or maybe Matt did. One of the other guys on the tour. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Bruce put that record out on his labels, like Seize the Day. He had just came up with a label name, I think, to put that album out.
Mm-hmm.
But I was super bummed because everywhere we played, with the exception of the showcase, it just was just such a low turnout and amazing bands. Living Sacrifice was still touring on Reborn,
uh-huh.
and just killing it every night.
Sure.
Embodiment had everything to prove because it was kind of their first tour.
Man, not only was Living Sacrifice playing Reborn in 98, but they had been playing on it for a year. So they had ratcheted that thing down. That must have been perfect, you know?
And Corey was playing it. Corey, who's the singer for Norma Jean now, and from Esocaris, he was playing guitar with Living Sacrifice on that tour. And okay. he's kind of an experimental, you know, guitar player. And he kind of threw in his little tweaks here and there. And it was just super fun to watch,
man.
And it bummed me out. And to this day, I still stand behind. And I know I've heard you say it before on your podcast is they Living Sacrifice never got the credit they deserved.
Never.
Ever. And they're an amazing band. Still, I like every release they've ever done for different reasons from the very beginning. And I think the last record they put out is phenomenal in its own right. And that's what bummed me out is like, I don't want to do this. To me, it's not worth the effort. If these kind of bands aren't getting the attention they deserve, there's nothing I'm going to do.
What chance do I have? That's exactly that's what I told Andrew from Torch. I'm like, if you guys can't, like, if you guys haven't figured it out, what the hell's Unteachers going to do? You know what I mean? Yeah. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Well, that's now. That's post the mess and Napster and the whole industry change.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking like back in the day. I hate to sound like an old man, but yeah, right. I remember going to Living Sacrifice shows and like this would have been the hammering tour where it was like, man, they drug an ordeal in there. There's five guys on stage. They're putting on a huge production and everything and place is half full. And I'm like, man, shame on everybody who isn't standing here watching this. This is, they ain't coming through here again. You guys blew it. You know what I mean? Ugh.
Yeah. And so that was kind of mine's like, I'm going to focus on, you know, getting a career and I'm still going to be involved. I'm just going to take a, I'm not going to, this, that was enough for me. I was like, I've never been the guy that thinks you should be able to make a living off of punk and hardcore.
Right.
But if you can do it and you don't have to change your sound, more power to you.
I don't think I don't know anybody who ever made a living off punk and hardcore. No one. They made a living off of it because they're involved in 19 different things.
Right.
And they accumulate a little bit of money from each one because they're smart. You know what I mean? It's like, like, look at the guys who they're in a band and they have a distro and they're a graphic artist and they make t-shirts for people and they're in another band and they have a studio and they've like, that's how they're making a career. Cause they work 28 hours a day. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Nobody's in a van playing Black Flag ripoffs and making a living. Black Flag couldn't do it. You know what I mean?
Definitely not.
Yep.
Even when you look at the bands that have kind of broke the mold with touring, like Hatebreed, for example.
Right.
I love Hatebreed, but their latest release is just not my thing, you know?
Right.
It's almost like they kind of tuned their sound down to, you know, to be a little more accessible to that heavy metal crowd, I guess. And
burned the edges.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, and I get it, you know, they're hustling, trying to do their thing. And I'm not going to put them down for it, but I even a band like that, that's, and I don't even think they're making, I mean, they probably make a living, but like you said, they're doing many other things.
Jamie's doing a podcast. He's managing Crowbar. Right. He cranks out three new t-shirts a week. I mean, yeah, he's a busy dude, you know?
Yeah. Coffee, death metal, and push-ups.
Yeah. You know it.
Definitely. Yeah. So you gotta respect the hustle for sure. And that's not something I wanted to do in terms of being in a band. So I just, at that point, I think when I got back, I focused more on what I could do with the label aspect of things.
Cool.
And then I started booking shows in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So I was doing a lot of, I approached booking shows the same way I approached the distro and the label, is I wanted to blend everything. I didn't want it to be secluded to, you know, certain belief systems within bands, just have everybody playing together. So I booked a lot of, in the late 90s and like 2000, I booked a lot of different shows at VFW halls. And we had this kind of gutter punk squat warehouse and just outside of downtown Dallas, where no cops or anything would ever come around. And it was called
The Warehouse or
the
Cigar Factory or The Knitting Factory or something that it used to be and now it's abandoned or something, right?
We called it Moon Tunes. It was called Moon Tunes.
Okay.
That's right. And so I brought quite a few bands through there and tried to really mix up the lineup of who's playing, you know, and somewhere around the time I started a band with some of the guys from Society's Finest and Within, and it was called The Fighting Academy.
Okay.
We actually put out a song do you remember the Akeldama? Akeldama Records. They put out a EP for a band called Subsist. Anyway, they were putting a comp together at the time, and it's got a song. It's got like Zayo's on there, Circle of Dead Children. It's just kind of a mixed bag of different bands. And And so that's like the one recording that my band, the Fighting Academy, has, was on that comp. And it's kind of that late 90s metalcore-y kind of sound. Not the best thing I've been involved with, but it was fun for what it was.
It's okay.
And then somewhere around there, I stopped booking shows and stopped doing the – I sold my distro like in 2001. I sold what I had left of the distro to Tom Angler, who was one of the crazy Angler brothers that was associated with No Innocent Victim and Dodging Bullets. I don't know if you remember that band.
I remember the name. Yeah.
Yeah. He had come through with – and I think with Disciple maybe, and I don't recall, maybe even Innocent Victim. And I was kind of looking to dump my distro. I was kind of over it. I had started this with this other band. We were called Legions Will Fall. It was a phenomenal band. You could still listen to it to this day, and it holds up. It's just an amazing band. I was looking to kind of put more of my effort into that band. And it was with some kind of legendary friends of mine around the Dallas-Fort Worth area that had been in different hardcore bands, death metal bands, grind bands. For lack of a better term, I guess you could say I was the only Christian in that band.
Okay.
So when we would play, there was just such a mixed bag of people that would come to see us. And exactly the way I always wanted my shows to go, you know.
Right.
So somewhere along there, I had
and there weren't any problems, right? I mean, you seemed like the type of guy that was like, "Yeah, this is what I'm about. This is never. This is my belief system, but I ain't gonna jam it down your throat or up your ass. That's just it's who I am. And you want to talk about it, cool. If not, let's rock. And there aren't problems when you act like that. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And yeah. I was never was about that. And I was really tired. In our area, we had, there were quite a few Christian venues that would just book, you know, they were ministries of churches or whatever. So I understand, I get it. But they had this crowd, like this crew of people that only went to those shows. And it just bugged the hell out of me. I was like, if you're really into hardcore and stuff, why don't you go to like hardcore shows outside of these venues? And it just that aspect of it always just bugged me.
It's too scary.
It's too scary. Yeah.
It's not my youth pastor is not there. Bad things gonna happen.
Right.
They don't even give you free fruit punch and cookies. Oh, shut up.
Right. Or have a coffee shop.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And it is what it is. I mean, it served its purpose, but it just wasn't my thing. And so somewhere along there, I put out the 7-inch for Esocaris. Which in 2000 is when I put it out.
Okay.
Before that, though, I put out the full length for Fed by Ravens in 99. Okay. So I only ever released three things. I put out the comp, Blessed Be This Killing, was 98. And 99, I put out Fed by Ravens full length. And then it's called The Service of Love. And then in 2000, I put out the Esocaris 7-inch.
So let's talk about that for a second real quick.
Yeah.
Was that like, were you making enough money off your Disciple 7-inches that you could actually fund this kind of stuff? Or is that Jared reaching into his wallet and paying for stuff?
A little bit of both.
I got you. Okay.
I was, the definitely any money that I got, except for when I went on that one tour, any money I got went straight back into the distro. And
it always labor. Does. No one ever makes money on it.
No, it was never. I had other jobs, you know. And so that was, it all paid for itself, definitely. Mm-hmm. And if I had to get more money after that comp with the Fed by Raven CD and the SoCare 7-inch, it was putting my own money into it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it all kind of evened out. I mean, I think I had accumulated a little bit of debt, but it's kind of a haze at this point. That's been, you know, 15 years ago. So
yeah, no one wants to talk about debt. That's a bummer.
Yeah, debt sucks.
Yeah.
But the SoCare 7-inch, I think because I am such a big vinyl nerd.
Uh-huh.
That's probably my favorite release that I did, just because of it was a 7-inch, and something that I feel like was kind of what, especially at the time, was very exclusive to punk and hardcore. You just didn't
very find out. Very didn't and in, and in 2000 out. you weren't riding a resurgence in 2000 either. You were selling it to people that wanted it,
and it sold right away. Like
it did.
And I've met people like I remember the craziest thing. The Daniel Davison, the drummer from the first drummer for Norma Jean.
Oh, dude, the guy who's played drums for everyone. Yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah, right. He 6-7 years ago when I went to see them, his wife was telling me that she mail ordered that for me, that 7-inch.
No way.
Yeah, it was just bizarre. You know, it's just like one of those bizarre things. And I thought that was cool. And the reason it came up is because I had like this stash of copies that I had kept. Uh-huh. I only pressed 500 of those 7-inches, but I'd kept like 25 or something. I don't remember the number.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave most of those to Corey to kind of give out. You know, I was like, I'm not the kind of guy that puts stuff up on eBay and sells it for, you know, ridiculous amounts of money for something like that.
You're not the guy who makes arrangements with the record store a couple weeks
before I hate that. I hate that right. So much.
Yeah, if anybody comes across that Circa Survive Sunny Day Real Estate 7-inch, it's not $90. Let me know and I'll buy it for you.
Is that your golden calf that you're?
That was the first time I've ever heard something for Record Store Day where it was like, you know what? Maybe I'll actually go out and stand in line like an idiot. But dude, they were all gone immediately, and I saw them on eBay. I saw one on eBay for $69.99. Like 6 days before Record Store Day. And I was like, this is a sham.
Unacceptable.
I it's gross what's going on. And I refuse to be a part of it. Man, I love that the industry is trying to do something to inject some excitement into the record industry, but you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what I'm talking about. I want to get a record store owner on this show and talk to him and be like, for realsies. What is Record Store Day to you? And he's probably going to say, dude, it's a big pain in the ass. You know?
It is. I can only imagine. Especially now that it's picked up a lot of steam over the past couple of years, and all the big record labels are kind of jumping in on it and, you know, putting out limited edition Paul McCartney records and stuff. And for me, vinyl has always been a punk and hardcore thing. And it helped for so many years carry all the bands that we love. You know, I remember going, buying from distros at shows and getting that rare 7-inch that you didn't even know was out, you know.
Right. It's about the discovery. It's about the, oh my God, I can't believe that's here. It's not exactly. It's not about like they're turning it into a get your Starbucks and stand in line for the new iPhone thing, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Screw that.
Not digging on that at all. Anyway, that could be a whole other episode, and all it's going to be is me bitching. So no one wants to.
Yeah, definitely. That was my point with the SoCare 7-inch. I wanted to put out, I put out 500 because it's what I could afford.
Right.
I guess,
right.
Basically. But I also like wanted it to be exclusive. Like you could only hear those songs. I gave them, you know, some nominal amount of money to record.
Yeah.
And they came out amazing, and they've always, those dudes and their integrity has always been spot on. They've never, they've never sidestepped me and tried to release those songs on anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think early on, like whenever Solid State repressed their LP, their album, they wanted to put those two Solid State wanted to put those songs from the 7-inch on that record. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you have to get in touch with Jared.
Right on.
At the time I was, you know, there was no social media. So I think I was kind of like a ghost and nobody could find me. So they didn't ever get put out on that, thankfully. But recently, Corey hit me up about maybe if I would be opposed to if they repressed it. And of course, if they're doing it and it's their thing, I have no problem with that. And they've always been straight up with me about keeping that exclusive to that 7-inch. And I've always appreciated that, because that's, I like having a copy of something that's only exclusive to that, you know.
Me too. Do you have any more? Can I buy one?
Yeah, I've got a few hidden gems. I'll send really? You one. I'm not. Yeah, I'll send you.
Let me pay a couple.
If you don't have the comp, I'll send you that one too. I've got a couple of those. It's probably nothing special anymore, but it's still, you know, it's a piece of history for my life. I'm proud of. So you're digging up some past, man. Fortunately and thankfully, I'm still friends with pretty much everybody. You know, there's no burn bridges. I moved away. You know, many years ago, I moved to Arizona and got married and started a family. So my home is always Texas. That's where I'm from, born and raised. But, I've lived out here for the past 10 years.
Jared, do all your exes live in Texas?
No, maybe not.
I don't know why I asked that. And I hope Steven edits that out. You know, he's not going to edit it out. He's going to do that stupid... Or he's gonna do that.
And I grew up with that song. You know, very very country. Family listened to a lot of George Strait back in the 80s. So
right on.
Yeah. But yeah. So I still keep up. And when guys are still in bands and they're coming through, I do my best to try to meet up with them. And in fact, we were in Newport and Huntington Beach this past week on vacation with my family, and Russ from Zayo lives out there now, and I hadn't seen him in many, many years, and got in touch with him, and we spent an evening with him, and it was cool to catch up with him. And
he's tough to get a hold of. I reached out to him. He was another one through Matt that said that he would do the podcast, and I reached out to him. He said he would do it. Can't get a hold of the dude. He's very busy, but he became like a crazy talented, like graphic video guy. Right.
Right. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. This stuff's amazing.
He's still the same dude, man. Still nice as ever. just the nicest guy, man. And a fun fact, here's another one. I don't drop this bomb many times very often.
Look out.
I was actually, they recorded Blood and Fire at Pointers in Little Rock. And so Chris from Embodiment and Joel from Society's Finest, on two different weekends, we drove out there and spent the weekend with them while they were recording that album. So that will forever go down, because that's still one of my favorite albums of all time.
Ladies and gentlemen, this man sat in the studio while Zayo was laying down Blood and Fire.
And I'll never forget
what were you doing that weekend?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It was a good time, and I'm not a name draw. I try not to be like the name dropper, and but that's some important history, and I've got that album still holds true as one of my favorites. Everything about it is good, and watching them, I think I was there for one weekend. It was drum tracks, and the next weekend was vocals. And
I seriously think Blood and Fire, Reborn, and Advent of a Miracle were three of the most important albums I've ever heard.
I have to throw in When Beauty Dies by Overcome was a big, was a huge monumental record for me, because it was kind of a departure from their first album, but it had that Southern California unbroken vibe to it. And the guys were, when I saw Overcome the first time in '95, I just thought they were like, they just looked cool to me. They had pompadours and their, you know, their hair's greasy hanging down on their face when they're, you know, they're like headbanging. I just thought it was like the coolest thing. You know, I was 95. I was like a junior in high school, and it was just, it just really stood out to me. And that I have to put When Beauty Dies up there with your list as well. When it comes to the,
there's
the
room up here. There's room, buddy. Set it right up here. That's
I don't know if you want to talk about it or not, but I did do a brief stint with Indwelling and Overcome as their the musical projects of those.
Go right ahead.
When I lived in Arizona the first time, my friend Jason Stinson from Overcome was starting. He wanted to do a death metal band, like harken back to like early Suffocation and that kind of stuff.
Okay. Yes. Now we're talking.
So I talked to him about it when he was in Texas. So in like 2001, when I moved to Arizona the first time, of course I got in contact with Stinson, and he had since started this death metal band called Indwelling. And, to make a long story short, he wanted, Thomas, the bass player, he sang, and they put out a full length on Face Down, and he did the vocals for it. Thomas did, but played bass as well. And he liked what I did in my band from Texas. It's called Legions Will Fall.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked the vocal approach and asked me if I wanted to do vocals for Indwelling. And I'm kind of a moderate death metal guy. I'm not like super into death metal.
Okay.
And I'd probably be more into like the grind aspect of that genre.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, that'd be fun. You know, it'd be fun to do this death metal band. And I didn't find it that challenging vocally, really. And so I did a couple practices with them, and I had no input whatsoever in that band. That was kind of their baby. But I played one show with them at the Showcase. Going back to that tour from 98, the same where the Solid State Showcase was,
mm-hmm.
that same stage, and played with them there. And then from that, I guess everything just kind of fizzled out with Indwelling. There was a brief time, I think, where I want to say Roy Culver was working at Solid State at the time.
Okay.
And he wanted to repress the full length and bring me into the studio and have me re-record the vocals, because the vocals were kind of low in the mix, and to kind of give it a more, I don't know, a more personal touch with me in the band. I don't remember exactly, but that never happened. The band kind of fizzled out, and for various reasons, and that never happened. So, okay. But it was super fun.
That's all right.
And I think anybody that follows the Overcome legacy, and who's into death metal, more like more of the late 80s, early 90s style of traditional death metal,
yeah,
would appreciate that. And and then I don't know if you know that he resurrected Overcome about six years ago, maybe.
Okay.
And he was talking to me about it. I'm talking about Jason Stinson, the vocalist, and he's always been like the mastermind behind Overcome, wrote all the songs. And, but he said he didn't want to sing for this Overcome. He wanted to just play guitar.
Oh, I see. Okay. I see.
So he asked me, what would you feel about doing vocals? I was like, you know, yeah, I don't sound like you, and I'm not going to try to sound like you. So if you're cool with me doing my thing, then I'll do it. And but at the time, he said, we're going to have Thomas, who is the singer for Indwelling. He's going to do vocals because I live 3 hours away. But he was going to move to like Eastern Europe somewhere for missionary work. So he was going to be exiting the band. Anyway, to make a long story short,
mm-hmm.
I never became the vocalist for Overcome. But I did do a lot of guest spots on there. They re-recorded some of the old songs and did a demo, and then recorded a full length for Face Down. And I did a bunch of guest spots, a lot of like the low end stuff on those two recordings. And then Thomas ended up not doing missionary work, and so he just stayed in the band, which worked out because he's local to the Phoenix area, and I'm not. And
gotcha.
And that they kind of ran its course, and they're not doing that anymore.
So in me digging around, I understand, I think I read this correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, three kids?
I do have three kids, yeah.
And your youngest was born with Down syndrome?
No, my I have two girls, and my middle mm-hmm. child is a boy, and he has Down syndrome, yeah.
Middle child, okay. At that point, what's his name?
His name is Judah.
Judah, and what are the girls' names?
I have Karis, which ironically is named after the band, but I spelled
it. That's awesome. I stumbled into that. That's awesome.
We spelled it with a K. I always liked the name and the meaning of it. And Karis. We spelled
it. What does it mean? What?
Undeserved grace. So
that's great.
So with SO is like within, and then Karis is undeserved grace. So it's like within undeserved grace. So I think is what, if I'm not mistaken. And I just always liked that Karis meant undeserved grace. And
that's beautiful.
Yeah. And so she's my oldest. She's 11. And then,
okay.
Then we had Judah. He's 9. And then mm-hmm. my baby, her name is Aveline, and she's 7.
Beautiful.
And we're done with kids.
I had 3 and I tapped out myself. I understand. Yeah. I'm in the same boat. So correct me if I'm wrong. I thought I read somewhere that upon having Judah and understanding the situation you were in, you wanted to understand more. So you went to school to be a special ed teacher. Is that right?
That's it. Yeah.
So you're telling me the day before Judah was born, you didn't have any plans on being a special ed teacher.
Never had plans on even going back to school. Yeah, definitely.
Dude, tell me about that. That's one of those moments that like a relay went off in your head, man.
Sure.
Tell me about it.
We were living in Texas at the time.
Uh-huh.
My wife is from Yuma, Arizona, which is where we live now.
How'd you meet her?
My brother was a pastor here in Yuma, like in 2001.
Uh-huh.
And I just needed a change. So I moved out here at that time, like in July of 2001.
Uh-huh.
And I lived out here for a couple years and met her at the church there.
Cool.
And, convinced her to move back to Texas with me, and we had our first daughter here in Yuma, and then we moved back to Texas, and Judah was born there.
Okay.
And then she needed her family support, basically, to kind of emotional support.
Sure.
For obvious reasons. And so had to kind of make the difficult decision of moving back to Arizona, which I did not want to do at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been almost 10 years.
Okay.
January it'll be 10 years. So it was a few months after he was born in October, and we moved in October of 2005, and we moved back to Yuma, Arizona in January of 2006.
Okay.
So I went, it was kind of like all this change was going on. I had worked as an electrician, working construction, and I kind of was like, you know, there's all this change going on, and I'm going to go back to school and see if I could even teach, you know, if it's something I would be interested in. So mm-hmm. the first class I took was like intro to special education, and I just wanted to, and I was hooked. I went to the community college out here, and that first class I took was an intro to special ed, and I was like, yeah, I want to do this. These people are pretty rad. And, if I was chosen to raise a kid like this, then I'm going to learn as much as I can and try to make his life the best possible, you know? So
if I was chosen to raise a kid like this.
Yeah, I believe
that. I like that.
I
perspective, dude.
Yeah, you got to.
Yeah,
you can complain about it, or you can sack up and make some real things happen. And I chose to sack up, I guess you could say. So
that might be the subtitle of this episode now. I might have to put sack up in there.
It's a very Christian title, sack up, you know.
It's in there somewhere. Might be, it's probably a new international version.
Yeah. So I moved him out here, and I went back to school. It took me about 5 years, and I worked off and on as an electrician, and worked at Lowe's and Boys and Girls Club and different things as I was going through school. And then I got a degree. I have a dual major in elementary and special education, and started coming up in August. I'll start my fifth year as a teacher. So, and I've been at the same school in the same class for the past 4 years, and he's at my school with me, but he's not in my class. Actually, he's always been in a general ed setting, in a general ed classroom, and he gets some pull out support where he's pulled out for some, you know, an hour or two a day. And then I have a, what's called a self-contained class, which would be probably the most, identifiable term that people are familiar, is like the special ed class, kind of off in the corner. That, you know, the kids are often overlooked or not known about. And I've really strived to make sure that that's not how my class is. So
Right. I know a little bit about this. My wife has a degree in occupational therapy, and she worked in gerontology for 20 years. And she had a sick brother who just passed away a couple of years ago, and she originally got into it because she wanted to help kids, but the opportunity was there for elderly. So then after my brother-in-law passed away, she was like, you know what, I'm going to go after the kid thing. So she got a job in IU, and my wife, God bless her, she's coming home with bite marks. She was dealing with it. I guess you understand, you're the teacher in the room. She kind of signed on as the teacher's assistant. So she gets a lot of the grunt work. So I always liken it to a basketball thing with this.
Yeah.
there's zone defense and there's one-on-one, right?
There is. Yeah.
She's one-on-one. She's matched up with this kid who's got severe autism. And when he doesn't get his way, he rips his clothes off. He bites my wife's coming home with bruises, where I'm thinking like, oh my God, people are going to try to lock me up. They're going to think I beat you. You know?
Sure. Yeah.
And, this is God's work, dude. This is tough stuff. And, when I read that you were, pardon me, I'm going to go out on a limb here. When you were blessed with the opportunity that Judah was born the way that he was, you decided to go do something. And instead of sitting around and, you know, being a victim like people have done. I'm not trying to be bold, but I mean, I'm watching it. My wife's coming home and explaining the family situations that these kids are coming from. And the families are just, dude, school is babysitting service. They're not doing anything to help these kids, you know?
It's half and half from my experience. Yeah.
Okay. 50, okay.
50-50.
Right. And, man, it's touching to hear that you thought not only can I learn more about my situation, but, I can give back, can help, you know what I mean?
And that comes from growing up in punk and hardcore. My Christian faith, I've had to come to a lot of terms with that, and I don't really want to get into that specifically.
Okay.
Of course the faith aspect of loving others and what I consider giving to the least of these is kind of where I'm at with that now.
Right on.
Is kind of that thriving, what keeps me, that's kind of what brought me there and keeps me there. But the idea of like the punk and hardcore thing of giving more of yourself and to your community, you know, and I was the punk and hardcore scene that I was raised in seemed to always be giving back in some way. Like I remember going to homeless shelters that weren't associated with Christian ministries, you know, giving to the homeless and taking care of, you know, taking care of the community in some way. You know, there's a lot of ethics in punk and hardcore that I wouldn't have ever been introduced to had I not been involved in that, you know?
Wow. So, no, I did not see that coming. That's a great point.
Yeah. So that, I think that was a, I definitely don't want to undermine my faith because that's kind of the driving force.
Sure.
But the way that I view ministry and stuff now is not from a church perspective. It's from a character perspective of where you're at as a person and a human being and how you're serving, you know, if you want to take it to the Bible, how you're serving orphans and widows. And I view the kids that I teach as the least of these, you know, what the Bible talks about, you know, giving to the least of these, and it's the ones that society shuns to a degree. And I think our society is coming around, but it's still, I mean, it's still, you know, it is what it is. So it's super fun, man. It's literally a labor of love. It's not like a sacrifice for me at all. I don't want to play like that card. Like it's, you know, like, oh, you know, I come home beat up and woe is me. And it's not like that for me. And it can be. Yeah. I mean, you definitely get bite marks and scratches and bruises and hit and kicked and what have you. But to me, that's such a small part of it that, I go to work stoked every day. Like I love hanging out with them. And I come home very satisfied, like very, very happy about how the day went. And there's been some really shitty days.
Sure.
When it comes to,
I can't wrap my head around what a shitty day must be for you, man.
But it, you know, when I worked as an electrician, especially out here in the desert Southwest, there were times where I was down in a 6-foot ditch digging and pulling wire, you know, 115 degree heat. And it just doesn't compare, you know.
Sure,
I'm not in Afghanistan or Iraq, you know. So it's for me to complain about what I do, it's just not going to happen. There are shitty days, but the shitty days are the ones that have to do with something that you had to deal with.
Yeah,
for like a child's misfortune, you know, abuse, or you know, so those are the days that it's like where you're having to deal with a family situation, it's not getting, you know, hit or bitten to me. And to be fair, I have five ladies that work under me as paraprofessionals or aides.
Uh-huh.
And they're the ones that take a big blunt of the right. Kind of the grunt work.
Right, right, so right.
I definitely have to. My classroom wouldn't, and I dare say any self-contained special education classroom wouldn't be effective without those paraprofessionals. So
sure, yeah, that's a talk about a labor of love, man. That's
that's my. It's really not any more complicated than that. It's super fun, and I've tried to do a lot of things that are to build inclusion. So a lot of my students spend time with general ed students, and I bring other classes into my class, and we've done a lot of good things at our school, and I'm very proud of a lot of the stuff that's come about in the 4 years that I've been doing it. And
mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm barely kind of catching my stride. So it's every year is different from the previous year. And, you know, it's just, it's fun, you know, lots of fun. And my son is super rad. You know, he's like my sidekick. He prefers to be with me most of the time, but he's at school. Like he actually gets offended if he has to come to my class. Like he's
offended. What do you mean?
Like he did. Well, now that he's older, you know, my class is kinder through second graders. So they're young, and a lot of them come in as like right out of preschool. So they seem, you know, they're very,
he's offended because of his age.
Yeah. Like he's like,
oh, I get it.
I'm not going in there with babies. Right. You know?
Yeah, dude, I'm 9.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? That's awesome.
He navigates the school on his own. You know, he doesn't, I mean, I'm there for a reason, you know, the whole reason I'm doing it is because of him. So my eye is always kind of on him and watching him and making sure he's taken care of. But, he's become super independent, you know, so he likes to have his independence. And of course, he's not academically at the same level as his peers, but he's adapted socially, and that's kind of always been our big thing. And he's learning a lot too. I mean, it's not that he is learning, but it's a big social deal for us, is getting him acquainted with the outside world, you know.
So let me ask you this, and this might take me a while to get there, but bear with me.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of listeners on this podcast. We're not big, but sure, we might be talking to one person who has a Down syndrome kid. Okay.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Tell me what you think. I mean, you're a good natured guy. You got a big heart, and Judah, his name's Judah, right?
Correct.
Judah was born the way that he was. You would have been a loving parent anyway.
Right.
But you're a loving parent who decided to get the book knowledge side of things, and you're actually a qualified professional now, right? I can say that. You're a teacher, right? What's the one thing that a qualified professional teacher would like to tell the people who are just parents of Down syndrome kids? Like, what's the big thing that you learned? I mean, maybe that's a huge question and you can't answer it in one sentence, but I mean, like, you took it to the next level and got book knowledge, college smarts on this level. Like, what's something that you'd like to tell them to encourage them or to explain to them that maybe they're just, I just love my kid. Maybe it's not cutting it sometimes. No. And you know what I mean? Like, go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
That's actually easy to answer. In fact, I'm
great. Good. Cause it was hard to ask. I didn't know what I was saying.
In fact, I have a blog, that I've been writing, I've been keeping since I started teaching.
Look so at you nailing the segue. Woo-hoo!
Yeah, I have to plug that because it is what it is.
That's where I was steering. Go ahead.
But I started it as more of like for my family and close friends. Like, I didn't make it public at all. It was very, very, you know, closed social media kind of blog in the in the beginning. And then anyway. So for this blog, it's called you can find it at justlistenharder.blogspot.com. It's not this post that I'm working on is actually about inclusion. And I'm kind of, if I could eventually, I would like to write a book on parents dealing with professionals from my perspective as a parent and a professional.
Wow.
And, the biggest thing that I see and that I've learned as a parent is that we're kind of taught as parents to be aggressive and defensive with our children navigating what we call the special education maze. And so my advice is to slow down, back off, and be patient with the professionals that are working with your children. For people that have children with Down syndrome and any special needs, really, your whole world changes for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, when they're babies, it becomes like this defensive, like you are defensive because you don't want, you're protecting them and you want what's best for them. And as I'm learning as a teacher, as I learned in college and as my dealings with parents, I'm learning that they need to slow down. Parents need to, for the most part, if you're a special educator, you're there because you want to be. It's not exactly the most sought after job. Okay. There's positions available nationwide. I mean, I could pretty much go anywhere I want with my degree and be able to find a job, you know, and it's not the most sought after job. And so the people that are there, and I know there's bad ones. I've had to deal with them, but for the most part, the special educator, it's a labor of love. And for parents to go in with it, with this kind of aggressive mentality of, you know, this is what I want for my kid and this is what I want them to do. And this is what I want you to do with them. And how come you're not doing this? And how come you're not doing that? And,
gotcha.
You know, they almost like we have a magic wand and we can just kind of wave it and they're, you know, they're going to be able to read and write, you know, in a year and that kind of thing.
Right.
is unacceptable. And that's my biggest advice. And like I said, I've been writing a blog or a post for my blog for months, and it's quite extensive. And I don't even know if I'm going to post it on the blog. Maybe I'll eventually, you know, use it as a book or something, you know, write a book, because it's so extensive. And it's just, it's basically like this unspoken kind of code of ethics on, as a parent, how to deal with professionals and special education and just education in general. And kindness goes a long way. And I'm telling, like, for me as the teacher, when you have a parent that's aggressive and rude, as with anything, you don't want to respond to it, you know, in a positive way.
Right on.
If you approach the professional with kindness and understanding, it just goes so much farther. And I've had to tell parents, slow down, pump the brakes a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, you need to, you know, take a step. You need to understand where I'm coming from before you jump to conclusions.
Absolutely.
And wow, not just, yeah,
good point.
Not just me, but any special educator that they're dealing with. Right. So yeah. And there's a lot of that. Like, if, you know, the blog is super extensive, you know, there's lots of posts on it, but people that are truly interested in reading about, like, my life as a parent and a special educator, and also coach for special basketball, for Special Olympics. So I deal with adults as well. If they're interested in that, you know, there's probably some things on there that if they took the time to browse around, that they could benefit from. I had to go public with it a couple of years ago because I was nominated for our Teacher of the Year, our county, Yuma County Teacher of the Year. And I had to do like this video and for it. And so I had to show that I had some sort of advocacy, you know. So I put it up. I put the blog on in my video, and I had to get parent permission to put, you know, the students on, you know, on the blog and that kind of thing. So that it became public a couple of years ago, and it gets like a ridiculous amount of hits.
I love it. That's awesome.
But it doesn't, I don't get too many comments. I found like more people comment on like the social media, but they don't comment on the blog itself, but mm-hmm. it's getting visited. So if people are taken away from that, then that's rad.
Look at the hardcore kid all grown up doing important things.
That's what happens, right? We grow up and the stuff that was, I guess you figure out what's the most important, you know?
Yeah. It was, dude, everything that we were chasing around in our 20s and everything was fun, but man,
yeah.
Walk away and go do something that matters to people. That's if anybody, absolutely. Yeah. If anybody can get that message, man, that's awesome. What a cool story. What a cool story. My favorite story so far.
Right on.
Seriously, because that hits close to home, man. This dude was like putting out records and comps and everything, and look at him now. Look what he's doing now. That's really cool. Who nominates? How does that come about? I mean, I know nothing about that. How do you get nominated for Teacher of the Year? Like, who brings that up?
Well, I think I know it depends on where you're from, you know, just depending on. I can speak for Yuma County, which is we're out here in the middle of the desert, basically on the border of California and Mexico.
Okay.
And so we're really kind of by ourselves. And so going through the process, I found out that actually Yuma County has the largest Teacher of the Year celebration, observation, that kind of thing in the whole state of Arizona. It's the biggest. Yeah, the biggest one. Because you get areas like Phoenix and Tucson, there's so many different school districts.
Oh, you guys are spread. So it's a geographical thing.
Right. And out here, we're, you know, there's four school districts in the county, four or five. There's some like outlier kind of way out kind of county in the counties mm-hmm. That have different school districts. But there's two main school districts in our and I work for Yuma School District 1, which is the largest and the first school district out here. So okay. The Rotary clubs, the local Rotary clubs, are the ones that actually do it. So it's mm-hmm. It's a Rotary, and then there's a Yuma Education Foundation, and they're the ones that kind of put it all on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty extensive process. You're nominated by your school first. And then you go through like a series of interviews with Rotary Club members.
Stop right there. Nominated by your school. So it's your peers put you up.
Your peers put you up initially.
Right on.
That's cool.
So when I was put up, I was like, oh, that's, and it was like my second year teaching. So I was like, oh, that's cool. Thank you. And I didn't, you know, I didn't expect much else. And then you go to the interviews with these Rotary people and, you know, I have, you know, I'm sleeved. I have tattoos. I don't cover them up even as a teacher.
Filthy.
Yeah. You know, I have a pompadour and greasy hair and, you know, cuffed jeans and what have you. And so I go into to this interview just myself, you know, I'm like, they're not going to choose me anyway. So why be something I'm not? So I just go in and I like advance to like the semifinal. So it goes from like 150 teachers down to like 15, I think.
Okay.
And then,
and you're that one, and you're the one that looks like,
right. And right. There's just no way. Like then you have to submit a video of like a day in your life kind of video. And, so I did mine to, Damn, It Feels Good to Be a Gangster as a soundtrack, you know, for the Ghetto Boys, which is, you know, old school Texas gangster rap.
And I question that choice, but it must have worked.
Well, it was tongue in cheek. Like,
right.
And it was very tongue in cheek. Cause I'm thinking they're not going to choose me. It's nobody's going to get the reference anyway, unless they've watched Office Space.
Office Space. Well, he's punching the print.
Right. Exactly. So, there's no words. Like it's just, I just loop the, you know, the beat or whatever. And I won. They chose me for Yuma County Teacher of the Year in 2013. And it was the most surreal and weird experience. Like I'm thinking the whole time I'm going through it, I'm thinking they're not even going to pick me. That's not even, and the further I got, the more I took it serious. Cause I started thinking, all right, if this actually goes through, then I need to see what kind of cool stuff I can do for my students. And that became my motivation. I was like, all right, I'm going to give it my best because there's some teachers that deserve it more than I, that didn't make it this far. And out of respect for them, I need to give it my best shot. And then on top of that, I need to be able to get some cool stuff for my students.
So
I did. And that was 2 years ago. And over those 2 years, a lot of really cool stuff has transpired. We got an adaptive playground that
because of you winning Teacher of the Year.
Right.
That's on the other side of Teacher of the Year is actually favor to the school district. And
right.
It's, wow. So,
after I won one of the local Rotary clubs, Fort Yuma Rotary, approached me about, I had said something in my speech, which I didn't, my acceptance speech, which I didn't even prepare. Like I didn't even write a speech. I just talked off the cuff. And if somebody is interested in seeing this, you can, if you type in like my name with like Yuma, Arizona, I think there's like a, you can see the speech and the newspaper article, I think, is on there. And I think I put it on my blog as well. Anyway, so in this, somewhere in my speech, I'd said something about that we had a really shitty playground.
Said shitty playground.
I don't think I worded it like that.
Okay, all right.
So they approached me after the banquet and said, what can we do to help you with your shitty playground? So I said, well, if you're asking, this is what I would love to have and what we need. And it took about 2 years, and over Christmas break, this past Christmas break, we put in through the gracious Fort Yuma Rotary, we've got an adaptive playground. So it has an actual wheelchair swing that a wheelchair can wheel into. And there's,
oh, is that what adaptive playground means? Okay.
Yeah. So you, ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. So gotcha. you have to, if you're going to make something accessible to somebody with a disability in a wheelchair.
Gotcha.
So for like, instead of saying ADA, just say adaptive playground.
Got it.
So we've got a wheelchair swing and this little path that they can wheel up to the playground structure. Mm-hmm. And for those that have the motivation or the ability, they can get out of their wheelchair and access the playground structure itself. And we share it with three kindergarten classes and two other self-contained classes. So it serves like about 130 students.
Okay.
And, and it was a pretty big deal, and definitely for me that was the kind of the crowning jewel of going through the Teacher of the Year thing, was being able to get something lasting like that. That was really the motivation.
Heck yeah.
I didn't know that it was going to transpire into like a playground, but when I was first going through it, but that's, it did. And there's been some other things, like community recognition, and I serve on different, I'm like on boards of directors and things now, which is for different community organizations that serve people with special needs. And that's really kind of like this weird grown thing that it's still like when I go to these board of directors meetings, I still feel like, I don't know that I should be the guy that's sitting here making these sort of financial decisions for your nonprofit. But it is.
Yes, you should. Yes, I wouldn't. If I lived in Yuma, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So it's been cool. And then the Special Olympics deal opened up for me after that. And so I'm very involved with our local Special Olympics, and started coaching basketball for the adults. And Judah's involved now with track with Special Olympics. And then we have adapted a curriculum that Special Olympics uses called Young Athletes, and we do that in my classroom as well. So it's been a cool ride, and like I said, I'm just kind of catching my stride, I feel like. So I'm having fun with it, and I'm enjoying summer breaks for sure.
That sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been this is my third summer break. My first summer break, I went back to work as an electrician, but for the past 3 years, I've been able to really soak up summer break and spend time with my children, and while mom's at work, and I try to plan stuff for them, and we do all kinds of fun stuff, go to the skate park and go to the movies, go out of town, camping, blah, 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 you know, fun dad kind of stuff.
Wow, that's great. Seriously, I know, what a cheesy, wow, that sounds great. No, seriously. Thanks. That's unbelievable. I think people would take that for granted given the opportunity. My wife's doing it. She is off this summer, and she's actually getting out of the gig I was just telling you about. And she's going to work like a couple hours at this job, she's going to piece together a paycheck from different companies and everything, but the school, she's going to get out of the IU thing, but yeah. She has the summer off, and she's like, this is rad. I, you know, like not having to go to work, and I can pick and choose and cover a vacation, and you know, but definitely. She has time to like take the kids places, and she's like getting dentist appointments in and stuff. I got to get up and go to work. I'm a robot. I'm a piece of machinery. You know, you just keep riding on this paycheck till it breaks. Good luck after I break.
Right. No, I was there for many years, and
yeah.
And everybody knows teachers don't get, that we don't get paid jack, you know. Sure. it's not, and I'm not complaining about that. I went into it knowing that, but mm-hmm. We do get summers and the different break, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas break and spring break and all of that, you know. To me, is having young children is just amazing for me to be able to spend that time with them. And and you know, I feel like especially my baby, I kind of missed her, kind of her baby and toddler years, because I was finishing up school during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been really important for me to get the time with her now. And I don't know, it's rad. It's a lot of fun, and I don't like to talk about it a whole lot, you know, because it's just, I'm just living life and trying to do with what I've been given and make the best of it. And you know, I have a little corner of the world, and you know, for so many years I was taught, you know, in different ministries and churches and stuff, that you have this great destiny and you're chosen for this and that. And I think so many times we get sidetracked with thinking that we have this great destiny, and we waste our time kind of pursuing these lofty goals and ideas of what we think we should be doing for God, when why can't we just start with where we're at and just our little corner of the world? And to me, that's been that I've found the most satisfaction, fulfillment, and happiness serving God through that, in that realm of this is what you've given me charge of, and I'm going to do the best I can with it. And I'm not going to think about some lofty destiny that some visionary church told me I should be following, you know?
Wow. Yeah. So, kind of hitting the nail on the head.
Yeah. And the way things circle around has been interesting for me in my life, for sure.
Certainly has. That's the whole reason we're having this conversation, man. This is, you've got five different life stories here, and it's all the same guy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's been interesting, but definitely being a husband and a father is my favorite thing about life. And then teaching comes right after that, definitely. But yeah, my wife and I have been married for 13 years, and it's been a wild ride, but super fun and rewarding.
Last thing, tell me about Beast of Burden.
Yeah. Beast of Burden is a kind
Rolling,
of a
class- Rolling Stones cover band, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
No? Oh no.
No, okay. No.
Wrong website. Okay. Get off.
No, the name actually comes from the working class kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a collaboration between my friend Jeff Schuster and I. About 5 years ago, he asked if I wanted to do a band with him. And he's a local guy that I met here after I moved to Yuma, who booked a lot of the hardcore shows locally. And he has another band called Beg for Life, which is toured and a really, really, really good band. And mm-hmm. So we got together about 5 years ago and started just kind of writing songs together, him on guitar and me on vocals, and telling him, or he'd show me a riff and say, what do you think about this? And you know, the process of writing music.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, but I don't want a tour. I don't want it to be a big deal. Like, I want everything with this band to be natural. Let's play what comes out naturally. Let's, you know, get people together to play in the band that we know and trust. And so it's actually just Beg for Life with me on vocals. It's
okay.
It's all the guys from his other band, and but a totally different sound. It's tuned to Slayer, and it's very eclectic in its approach. So it's I'd say our biggest influence are definitely drawn from mid to late 80s New York hardcore and thrash. So it has very thrashy elements to it. And thrash in terms of, like, of course, Anthrax. There's some anthraxy stuff. And then, mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with Agnostic Front's Cause for Alarm record, is pretty big influence. And there's Stormtroopers of Death. There's quite a few. I would say if you're into New York hardcore and you're into kind of the crossover era of, like, thrash and hardcore, it's something you could understand and be into. Sure. If you're not into any one of those, you hate it. And my vocals are very straightforward and not anything like I did in any of the other bands I'd done before. It's very, very much more straightforward. But the band is, like, it's come out.
There's no clean emo vocals in the back.
Oh, there never has been. Not in any band. Not into that. I read a review somewhere probably 10 years ago when that stuff was big, that clean emo singing. It said that we needed like a clean emo eraser.
Oh,
just erase those parts out.
I'd pay money for it.
But yeah, none of that. But it's just a fun band. And we play regionally. We've only played out of town in Phoenix, and we've been a band for, like, we put the band together about 2.5 years ago. And, we've got one song we recorded in February, and the lyrics are very real life experiences for me. I've written all the lyrics, and it's very real life experiences for me. And so kind of has, there's some stuff in there about, you know, students that I've worked with. There's stuff in there about being a father, you know, just different experiences like right that.
Working class stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
This is available on Bandcamp, right?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
You're gonna have to send me some of these songs. We're gonna use some of this music. You know, if you've listened to my podcast before, Steven kind of seamlessly drops the stuff in there.
Sure.
We'll definitely put your stuff in there.
Yeah, I'll send you maybe like Legions Will Fall. I think that for those guys, the guys in the Legions Will Fall band, at one point we were gonna be managed by Billy Milano. So I think that says a lot for the guys in that band. You know, Billy Milano from Stormtroopers of Death and MOD. He had moved to the Dallas area back in like 2000 and had shown shown some interest and I'm probably going to screw up the story a little bit, but I didn't care for him. We played like his birthday party and I just didn't like him. And I don't remember how it transpired, but I do recall like voicing my dislike for him, even though I love his bands and I'm sure he's a good dude. I just didn't like him at his birthday party.
Okay.
And it was a big show and we actually played in front of like Dimebag and Vinnie Paul.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really cool. And this was like,
did you meet Dime?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And my one regret, I don't have many regrets in life. I have a few, but my one musical regret is that I didn't at least get a picture with him. But who would have known that a few years later, you know, that would have happened. And I've never been like a fanboy kind of guy. Like to me, my musical heroes have always been approachable. So it's never been like this thing where I feel like I need to get a picture or an autograph.
Right. I got you.
Maybe when I was like a teenager, but not as a grown man or anything.
Right. Yeah. I feel weird throwing my arm around a guy and be like, selfie. Yeah.
Right.
But
my satisfaction was playing live and seeing those two guys, Vinny and Dimebag, in the like just behind the pit with kind of their entourage surrounding them with their arms folded and their heads bobbing. You know, that to me was a very worthy justification for playing that birthday party.
See, I thought we were done, and look at the other stuff. That's beautiful. You played in front of Dime and Vinny. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And those guys, man, those guys in that band, Legions Will Fall, went on to do and still are doing some really cool stuff musically. That band was just a really good band that I kind of left prematurely. But it is what it is. It's just, you know, the way things play out. And I love those dudes and that. But that band, if I had stuck with that band, we probably could have gone on to do something, you know, nominally successful, I guess, for mm-hmm. what it was, you know, definitely touring, but again, not something I ever really cared to do. So,
bigger fish to fry, man.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. I'll send you one of those tracks and maybe like one of the Overcome tracks that I did the guest spot on. And then,
yeah, cool.
And then the one Beast of Burden song that we've recorded, trying to get us, we want to record a 7-inch. But you know, this day and age, you know how it is. If you're with your band, getting somebody like putting it out yourself is like, I'm a grown man. I'd rather, you know, I've got so many different hobbies. It's like, do I really want to put money towards putting a 7-inch out myself?
Nope.
That nobody,
one's going to buy. No.
Yeah. I would like to think people would, but I don't have the hustle to hustle my band. I don't really care because it's just fun, you know. Like
I'm done with all of it. The moment I'm currently in a band, and me and Steven are always working together and stuff. And I do the website and the band camp and all that and everything. I got it all on there. I'm doing it strictly because it's still fun. The moment it stops becoming fun, I have 90 other things to do. I'll walk away. I'll come back. I don't care.
Exactly
how I don't care anymore, dude. I don't
exactly
care.
How I feel.
If 3,000 people heard the new song or if 3 people heard the new song, don't care.
It's you're having fun with it.
Nope. That's all it is. I'm getting ready for the next podcast or I'm taking my kid to the mall or whatever. Like, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. Awesome. What a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, dude, it's been cool. I appreciate the opportunity for sure.
I know you're not a big limelight guy, so you know, don't feel weird dragging yourself out for people to hear your story, because it's a good one. It's a really good one. I'm glad it went the way it did.
Right on. Thank you.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.